In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
That's scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
You walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to another news. I'm Jeff Brady. Many years ago now, the seemingly random sightings of strange clowns made headline news. Reports of the individuals dressed as clowns were witnessed in forests, under bridges, behind dumpsters, and roaming suburban neighborhoods. Taking that cue, the origins of the clown were explored on this show, and with guests examining the broader human psychological element within Western culture. The evil clown, with the white face, big red smile, and sharp teeth, reveal the lack of a healing shaman within society, according to past guest, Jungian expert Laura Shapira. In this reduction, the absence of a healer within the collective brings forth imbalance. Many years ago, the secret group, the Order of the Jesters, was discussed on the show. That order is known to be composed by invitation only of higher-ranking Freemasons and connected directly to the crown. The Jesters are among several occult groups that wear the multicolor clown costume, including the Shriners. Investigations reveal, and listeners have known, that these events are much more than a festive masquerade. They're often ritual occult ceremonies inviting ancient disembodied predators to revel and share in debauched activity. The Jester, the Clown, the Harlequin, strange avatars surviving centuries of change and reset. Our guest, Paul Stobbs, has taken this topic and greatly expanded on the research in many directions. He examines how the concept of colorful clown beings are worshipped in ceremonies and span across time. It's also woven through modern and indigenous culture. Paul brings forth his theory, the offspring of the biblical fallen ones, the Nephilim, the giants, actually bear a striking resemblance to the clown archetype. He spent years researching various aspects of the theory and has now published the book titled The Nephilim Look Like Clowns, Volume 1, The History. Paul Stobbs, welcome to another news.
Hi there, thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. There seems to be no end to the depth of this topic. There are endless images of nasty, evil-looking clowns online, and oddly, a lot of images of clown tattoos. You've exposed how the clown archetype has haunted the collective human mind for many centuries. It's intentionally embedded into certain areas of mass culture, such as music and visual art. To begin with, Paul, you've had experiences with psychedelics years ago, maybe more than most people. Your story sounds like the hero's journey as outlined by Joseph Campbell. However, after you stopped doing drugs, you had an important insight, a vision of a creature known to be seen by those experiencing this altered state of consciousness. Would you please walk listeners through what happened and describe what this being looked like, because you stumbled onto something life-changing for many. Tell listeners how you drew a connection to the familiar clown archetype as being the offspring of fallen angels.
Sure. So I don't come from a religious background myself. I was born and raised in the northwest of England. A pretty drab, grey, dry, working class part of the world. Religion was just never really a part of my my upbringing. It wasn't really even talked about. But I did grow up as an artist, a creative mind, an observant mind, looking at the world around me, craving some kind of connection to God or spiritual ideas. You know, I've always been that kind of guy. And being a stereotypical artist, when I got into my my teen years and my early 20s, I really did kind of go deep into the drug world. And in a way, you know, I wouldn't call myself a new age hippie of any type. I didn't grow dreadlocks, start walking around on the grass and humming along with crystals or anything. You know, I wasn't that type of person. But I was certainly looking for something divine. You know, I was trying to find some kind of connection to the big unknown. And I having no context or know-how to get to that understanding, I suppose drugs offered that perspective through the psychedelic arena. So I did explore that realm quite heavily during those late formative years of my life, you know, and I really got into, you know, trying to understand the nature of reality from the psychedelic perspective. Again, observing the world through sacred geometry and patterns and the fractalized nature of reality and what does it mean to have a soul within a body? Am I the body or am I the soul or the interconnected? All these type of thoughts and questions I was asking and searching for answers for. And during all that time in my life, you know, I was always bumping into the culture of psychedelics online and, you know, people often on forums discussing the work of Carl Jung, you know, the collective unconscious and the archetypes found within there that represents different aspects of humanity's shadow, shall we say, you know. And one common theme which always cropped up in the psychedelic community was this idea of meeting the shadow of humanity in the form of a jester. While in these psychedelic realms, as they would describe them. And I had no reason to doubt that perspective or understanding or interpretation of what we were looking at, you know. Why would I have any other reason to question it? I didn't really know what I was looking at or exploring at the time. But I was doing an art degree, fine art, at Lincoln University, which was on the other side of the country from where I was raised. You know, I was right next to this beautiful cathedral, studying every day. And painting and drawing and sculpting and trying to master my art, you know. And my subject matter became this idea, this concept of what does it mean to be a human being with a soul and what does a psychedelic perspective really offer us? But I wouldn't say I was like looking to communicate with entities necessarily, but I was doing these things on a quasi-daily basis, you know, if not weekly. Getting stronger and harder with what I was doing, starting with salvia when I was 16 and working my way up to DMT by the time I was 21, you know. And DMT is what's been dubbed like the spirit molecule in the psychedelic community. It's considered the be-all, end-all of powerful psychedelic entheogens that give you a spiritual experience every time without fail within 5 minutes of inhaling the thing, you know, 30 seconds to 5 minutes of ingesting this stuff. So when I managed to get my hands on that and I really got into these realms, it proved to me, you know, through many experiences, okay, so there is a spiritual realm. So yeah, you know, I was searching for these answers, and when I got hold of DMT, it proved to me, okay, so there is a spirit realm. That much is back. I couldn't really deny it. I'd seen too much by that point, you know. And again, I'd constantly been reminded through all the other people involved with these things online in the forums and that I was involved with that. Okay, so people see entities, but I just didn't meet them during these experiences. You know, when I was going to these places, I was doing everything by the book to get the most powerful experience you could from these. You know, I wasn't doing it lightly. I was going hard, you know, because I wanted to break through and have that experience with the other, you know, that people I really, really want to get through this experience. And, you know, I did the Terence McKenna method, you know, inhale 3 times and hold it for 10 seconds, you know, and basically until you're out of breath and let it go, you know. And I did DMT about 3 times, maybe 2 or 3 times in total, maybe over 2 different sessions, you know. And I did go to these other realms that people were talking about. And the best way to describe it really is something like a cosmic divine circus of some kind. It's like an extremely psychedelic, fractaled, ever constantly changing, moving realm, which is colorful and dancing almost with its own beat, you know. And you are very much there. It's tangible, you know, and you are consciously exploring these other places. It's very bizarre, very alien. But when I was there, even though I was seeing the place, nothing communicated with me during that time. And I didn't know what to make of that. And it's not like I was like craving necessarily to communicate with these entities because I didn't really know what I was dealing with. But I found it odd that through all this talk online about encountering entities during DMT, I found it odd that I wasn't getting this experience. But I wasn't disheartened by that because I took it for what it was worth and I learned a lot from those experiences. Now, around the same time of doing all of this, I was also falling into the conspiracy realm. And, you know, for people who don't know, I have a channel called Understanding Conspiracy Now with 75,000 subscribers. I've had it for about, you know, 10 years. And really much of it came at the end of university because of this. And I am first and foremost a scattershot conspiracy theorist, you know. But during this early time in my life, halfway through my university degrees, when I really fell into the conspiracy realm, it was 2012 and the end of the world was around the corner, you know. And I just had to know what people were finding to make them believe such things. So I fell into those rabbit holes, which are just a hell of a journey in their own right, almost on par with a psychedelic experience, you know, learning a lot of horrible dark truths about the nature of reality and the secret hidden hands of the occult, while also trying to explore these psychedelic realms, you know. So it all kind of mashed together, and I started to encounter a lot of information and knowledge surrounding spiritual creatures, you know, spiritual warfare from a Christian perspective. And the New Age perspective was always around, trying to explain these beings that people see as something like ascended masters or spirit guides or something, or ancestor beings of some kind, here to help us ascend and advance our consciousness to the fifth dimension or some nonsense like that. But then the Christian angle was always telling me, no, these are ancient, evil, demonic entities that are there for a reason. They're trapped there after dying in a pre-flood age. And their soul, their spirit was stuck on Earth, and all you're communicating with are those disembodied entities. And that stuck with me. So when I was doing my my last DMT experience, you know, being a year or two into this conspiracy understanding and research, I was very apprehensive. You know, I was like, okay, what am I really dealing with here? But when I did the thing, again, nothing came to me, but I did have this understanding, this knowledge from it that, okay, so God is real and this is a creation. There is a spirit realm. All that I see physically and experience with my senses normally on a day-to-day basis is not all that there is. That was made very clear. But again, no entities. But I did end up, you know, through years, 3 years of studying the biblical perspective and the conspiratorial stuff and having these spiritual experiences through psychedelics, I did end up with no answers, because I was looking for answers in the Eastern spiritual mystic perspectives, you know, the occultic perspectives, the Gnostic hermetical perspectives, you know, the psychedelic perspective, and I got nothing. I had no idea how to interpret half the things that were going on or to understand what I was really experiencing, but the biblical perspective was something I kept bumping into in my conspiracy research, which was providing a lot of satisfactory answers. What is the nature of reality? What does it mean for there to be a God? What does it mean for us to need a savior and all these type of things? And also, what are we dealing with when we deal with these spirit realms? And if you look at things like the Book of Enoch, you know, it explains very clearly what these entities are and where they came from. They are the disembodied spirits of giants that used to walk around on the earth. That's one of these perspectives that, you know, gave me some context to finally have any reason to take the biblical narrative seriously. Because that's not the kind of thing you learn about in church, you know, and it's not really something, it's not your Sunday, typical Sunday school type of lesson, is it, you know, about giants wandering around in an ancient time, eating people and subjugating them, and angels mating with human women and all this type of thing. But it kind of helped explain for me why we even have a spiritual problem to begin with and where demonic entities would come from. And I kind of got to the end of my degree with no direction, and I sincerely asked God, okay, so if you're real, help me, because I don't know what I'm doing. I haven't got a clue. You know, I've been looking for answers and found nothing. I've heard a lot about you, you know, show me, please. You know, and I was at the end of my tether, utterly burnt out through all these psychedelic experiences and just trying to find answers and getting nowhere.
This is after you finish your fine arts degree?
Just as I was about to graduate, yeah. From that day, things rapidly changed for me, is all I could say. I accidentally baptized myself, because I actually ran a bath after that. When I went under the water, I had this intense, powerful feeling in my core, and I had to leap out of the bath and kind of pant, and almost like I was having a panic attack in the mirror. But it wasn't bad. It wasn't a negative feeling. It was just overwhelming, you know. And I didn't know now, but I look back at it in hindsight and wonder if that's what actually happened that day. You know, I asked for help from God, I gave myself to him, and then inadvertently baptized myself in a bathtub afterwards. So it's that type of thing. But whether that's true or not, or that's what happened, I can testify that from that day, things did change for me drastically. I dropped all my addictions, and what I used to crave and seek after in terms of fleshly things, I just no longer had any desire for. And when I did do things like smoke cannabis or live a promiscuous lifestyle or lust or covet or whatever sin you want to talk about, you know, and I was quite a hedonistic guy, you know, typical art student, stereotype art student. I just could no longer do it anymore without feeling this conviction over me. And it's been a 10-year process, but I'm now like a happily married guy with a second kid on the way who's got managerial experience, you know, and has managed to establish. So I'm a completely different person, you know, and I'm calmer, I'm completely sober. I don't drink, I don't do anything like that. And I'm happier than I've ever been. And I do wonder if I continued down my previous lifestyle, I probably would be dead, you know. So I do think God saved me that day, and he did show me from that day many things, you know, hints and gentle pushings here and there to research certain topics. And in odd ways, you know, information comes across and you end up networking with people in ways that just seem so out of the blue and random. You receive random emails here and there. And I've, like I said, I've built this channel now where I've talked to a lot of big authors and people and players in the game of conspiracy from a Christian perspective. And I've been seeping myself in biblical history about demonology, you know, and during this early time, those 2 years after 2014, when I did give myself to God, I had all these experiences that I kind of needed to make sense of from a new biblical perspective. And I kept having these spiritual, horrible attacks by demons. You know, it started to happen. Only after did I quit all these psychedelics did I actually see the jesters, you know, which seemed so odd at the time. But in hindsight, I look back at this now and I wonder if it was more of a, when I was not saved, they were happy to remain hidden, because why give the game away? You know, it's kind of, I think I was a useful vessel for them, because I did live quite a hedonistic, self-centered life, you know, and I think I was a useful tool for these entities to live vicariously through my senses as I partook in sinful acts and pleasures, shall we say, you know. So it's best for a demon to remain hidden as long as the host doesn't know you're there. You can't get rid of them type of situation, you know. So I don't think they wanted to rock the boat when I was doing these drugs and reveal themselves. But after I gave myself to Christ, I was viciously attacked, spiritually speaking, you know. And I was...
Can you describe some of these attacks?
Sure, yeah. Like sleep paralysis was one of the big ones, constantly waking up paralyzed in my bed with a horrible demon on my chest strangling me. And, you know, you have to kind of wrench yourself awake screaming from those type of experiences. It's very difficult to know what to do. I had dreams, a dream where I was chased by a character called the Hat Man. And I have a video on my channel kind of detailing this whole experience. But that entity was there to kill me. I knew it was. And it even said to me I owed it something. Like, it came to collect on its end of the bargain or something like that. So maybe I made some kind of contract with this demon in a previous dream. I don't know what was going on, but that thing came to kill me. I've never felt evil quite like the presence of that character. And he had like a big, wide, purple-brimmed fedora hat with a purple trench coat, a shadowy figure with glowing eyes coming at me with like multicolored ribbons flying off the back of him. And it was nuts, you know. But then after that dream, I look into it and it turns out thousands of people have encountered the Hat Man, you know, and I didn't know anything about him until that own experience. So things like that kept happening. I had another experience where I was in my parents' living room. I think I was dog sitting or something, and I went paralyzed. I collapsed and I couldn't move, completely unprovoked. See, I was doing nothing, completely innocuous, you know. I was just sat there on the sofa. The TV must have been on. I was doom scrolling through my phone or something, you know, and my dog was next to me. And I just went paralyzed and I just collapsed onto the arm of the chair. And then darkness just crept in from the corner of my vision and I was going blind. I couldn't move. And some kind of mandala-like psychedelic portal started to crunch open from everything in the room in front of me. And I was kind of being pulled into it, you know. And as far as I was concerned, I'm dying. Like this, I mean, I think at the time I was like, have I had a stroke? am I having a brain aneurysm or something? Like, I thought, this is it, Paul, you're about to die. You know, I was ready to die. And it certainly felt like that was what was going on. It felt like something was trying to tear myself from my body, you know. So all I could do in that moment was say, barely, just this quiet whisper through my voice, verbally, Jesus, help me. And instantly it stopped. And I'm talking like, snap your finger, you're back in the room, I'm upright, panting, sweating, terrified, you know, but it stopped. And prior to that, I'd also had a random vision. And this is where the work we're going to get into today kind of began for me. I saw one of the jesters that people had been seeing on DMT quite frequently. But by this point, I'm like a year, 2 years sober from that stuff. I haven't touched the stuff, you know. But I end up being in the DMT realm for no reason. I wasn't doing anything. I wasn't inhaling anything. I just ended up back there for 10 seconds. It must have been maybe 10. It wasn't long, you know. I didn't get my stopwatch out or anything. But I wasn't there long enough to, you know, explore much. But just to quickly look up and see an enormous black and white line, big, wide, purple, grinning mouth, bulging-eyed, glowing jester monster thing with like a head shaped like spider's legs turned upside down, you know what I mean? And you could make it something akin to like a jester's hat with bells, but it wasn't a hat. Its skull was shaped like that, you know, and it wasn't wearing a jester's costume. Its skin was that color, black and white lines, like a corn snake or something, you know. And I just literally saw this thing for 10 seconds, and then it's enormous, by the way. I'm looking up at this, like a 50 foot tall behemoth, and then bam, I'm back. And then, like I said, no longer after, I have this paralysis situation, and I didn't know what to make of any of it until I said, you know, Jesus, help me, and it stopped. And that was a faith solidifier. You know, I was early in my faith at this point. I'd only just given God a chance, you know, like a year prior. So to suddenly give myself to God, then have all these horrible, heavy demonic attacks, I'd learned enough to know that calling on Jesus can save you in these situations, and I did, and it worked. So for me, I mean, I can't prove this to anyone, but I'm pretty much solidified in my faith. You know, I believe, and I believe in the power of his name over these, and I also believe we are in a serious war here with malevolent entities that want to kill us, spiritually speaking. You know, and even in a literal physical sense, it seems they'll do that. And I think, like I said, the attitude was, well, if we can't have you, Paul, nobody can. So they came for me early to try and kill me before I had a chance to realize my authority in Christ, you know. And I think after utilizing that, I haven't been demonically oppressed ever since, really. Don't get me wrong, I think everyone is always being demonically oppressed, but they've never actively been so bold as to try and reveal themselves and kill me like they have done then, you know. And I think it's because it's kind of like, well, it's too dangerous now. He realizes what he's capable of. He's accepted Christ, so let's just not bother, you know, let's move on. But I do think it was an attempt to kill me then, looking back.
Yeah, they really had shown their hand, and yeah, it seemed to be part of a larger plan, ultimately, because you were shown this entity. It looks like a jester. And yeah, a jester, clown, harlequin, whatever this is, that's a real strong archetype in this other world, but it's here too. And mm-hmm. You started connecting dots. What happened there?
Yes, yeah, so like I said, I've been seeped enough in biblical history by this point to know a thing or two, like, okay, so I'm dealing with demonic entities, and visually speaking, they look like jesters. And the only explanation biblically we have to explain what these creatures are is that they're the disembodied spirits of giants, half hybrid, angel human hybrids, you know, half and half, the offspring of angels mating with human women. And they look like clowns, is what I'm realizing, you know, from these experiences. But I was like, no way. This is odd. Because by this point, you know, you have to understand, during this early stages of conspiracy research, anyone who... And the Nephilim was a popular topic, you know, back in the day, to another 2014 era onwards, 2016 era. And you had players like Rob Skiba, you know, may God rest his soul, I think he's passed away now, but he was like talking about these and doing presentations about the Nephilim all the time. But his representations were always like hench bodybuilder types, human-looking bodybuilders like Arnold Schwarzenegger or Conan the Barbarian-looking things, you know, with like tanned, ripped muscles and you know, long brown dreadlocked hair and loincloths and stuff like this. But it looked very human, just big. And I was like, no. No way would a dragon human hybrid look like that. That's just not what they would look like. You know, and I'm an autistic guy and I had a bit of a creative mind. So I was trying to, I did like drawings and stuff of what, you know, we have these elongated skulls, for example, like the Paracca skulls and the Inca skulls, you know, that have these non-human features. And it's like, the people say this must have been what the Nephilim had, these elongated heads. So I took these skulls and I tried to layer over its skin, you know, what would they have looked like? And I realized they have this big, long forehead and they would have had red hair. The hair would have likely grown from the sides. And I started getting like jester-like, clown-like imagery kind of appearing again, you know. And I didn't know exactly that there was like a connection between clowns and the Nephilim by this point, but I had this hunch, this inkling to go off. So I just did a preliminary search. Nephilim and clowns, you know, Nephilim jesters. And I scoured the internet and I found nothing until I came across one video by some very small YouTube channel called The Epic Conspiracy. And even to this day, I think it still has like 200 subscribers or something. I checked like 6 months ago. And it wasn't a serious YouTube channel. It was just some guy making mockumentaries, making fun of conspiracy theorists. So he would do a History Channel style expose on the Nephilim, you know. And he would basically talk about the Nephilim like, well, the Nephilim were white-skinned, tall, with big, like, double rows of teeth and red hair. There's only one explanation. They're interdimensional killer clowns from out of space, you know. And he made this joke at the conspiracy theorist's expense. He was basically saying anyone who believes in the Nephilim is an absolute moron. You know, that's right. That was his point of view. But from that mocking thing he did, I realized, okay, so there's something here between clowns. It sparked my interest even more, you know. And I didn't really care that he was mocking or anything. It's just that's the only reference I ever found anywhere on the internet where someone had put clown and Nephilim together. You know, there's nothing. So I rolled with it.
I haven't heard this connection with the clown and the Nephilim or the offspring of the fallen angel before. And how could humans and these dragons mate anyway? That's impossible, right?
Well, you'd think so, wouldn't you? But I think angels have the ability to shapeshift. And if you look all throughout Greek mythology, it's all about the gods continuously making many forms of themselves and raping women and impregnating them. That's pretty much all Greek mythology. In fact, Zeus was infamous for doing that. I think he had over 40 human offspring and 40 more offspring with like other gods, you know. And the stories that you read in those mythologies are wild. And it wasn't just him, it's Poseidon as well and Dionysus. I think there's one example of, I think it might have been Dionysus shapeshifting into some grapes and somehow impregnating a woman. And there's many stories of Zeus becoming like the husband of a queen and pretending to be the king. And while the king's away on business, he'd replace him like a body double, you know, like a doppelganger, and then just sleep with the queen for like 2 weeks, impregnate her and disappear when the king came back. Things like that, you know. So I think angels or, you know, these, which in their truest form are dragons, you know, but they have the ability to shapeshift into human form. I think they're capable of impregnating women, no problem. Most of mythology is rife with those stories. I think, that, biblically speaking, it says the angels don't marry. They take no wives and don't marry. But it's more of a they shouldn't, not that they can't. And it would be much of an angelic rebellion if they were allowed anyway, you know. And I think if you look into the story of the angelic rebellion and the rebellion of Lucifer falling from heaven, taking a third of the angels with him, and you coincide that with the serpent tempting Eve in the garden, you know, and making her rebel against God in her own right and begin foster that rebellion, getting us kicked out. It seems like there was this serious angelic beef with humanity. Some angels were simply not happy that God had chosen humanity to rule over the earth and be gods among the earth, you know, and the master king caretaker of earth. I think a lot of these seraphim angels, these dragon-type reptilian angels of that kind, were jealous. And it's jealousy and pride which fundamentally led to the fall of these angels. And I think when the Mount Hermon situation happened during the early stages of humanity developing themselves, you know, after Cain killed Abel, he went off and started a city. And he took a wife. He built a city and he took a wife. Where did he get a wife from? You know, and who do you build? You build cities for large populations, but we're supposed to believe that there's no other humans around during this time. But I think authors like Gary Wayne, for example, have made very compelling cases that there were other humans around other than Adam and Eve at that point. And even in Genesis, there seems to be two parallel creation stories. You know, God created man and woman, plural, and told them to go forth and multiply and subdue the earth. Then it cuts to the next scene. God created Adam and put him in a garden. Two different stories, you know. And I think the people who first created these proto-humans, should we say, maybe they were the same as Adam, and Adam was just kind of set aside, you know, to be groomed and trained to be the king or something. But clearly, whenever Cain was exiled from his family after the Garden of Eden event and after murdering Abel, he went forth and built a city. So he must have had a labor force. He must have been able to convince people to follow him to build a city, you know. And he named it Enoch after his first son. So they have these two lineages in the Bible. You have the sons and daughters of Seth, and you have the sons and daughters of Cain. And it seems like Cain's lineage was pretty brutal. You know, you read the works of like early Jewish historians trying to recount these moments of what it would have been like. And I think Josephus was talking about this as well, you know, quite a famous Jewish historian. And he was saying, you know, Cain basically took the knowledge he learned from Adam from the Garden of Eden and went forth and subjugated all of humanity with it, whoever he came in contact with. And he very much dominated. He built cities, you know, and he created infrastructure of war and dominance over nature. While Seth's lineage were more agrarian type humans who lived in balance with nature, you know, and in harmony with it type of thing. But by the sixth generation to Jared from Seth, we know that there was an incursion. This is the Mount Hermon event where the angels came down and mated with human women. But I think it was more of an enemy of my enemies, my friend situation. And I think the angels came to Cain, came to his offspring, because they were in active rebellion against God. And while the angels had their own rebellion going on, they decided to work together. And I think it was the daughters of Cain specifically who mated with the first angels, the Watchers, who were sent to Earth, you know, under the presumption that they were going to look over humanity, but instead saw that the daughters of man were fair and took wives of them. And I think some of the angels may have even been tricked. I think Samyaza, who's said to be the leader of this clan, these 200 angels, he was working in cahoots perhaps with Lucifer himself in the main rebellion, but he possibly dragged these angels down with him, you know, who knows. So we get to the example of what the offspring would have looked like. Well, it's funny because if you look at some extra biblical texts, there's a book called the Book of Lamech of Cain and Leviathan. So Lamech is like the seventh generation from Cain on Cain's side. There's also a Lamech on Seth's lineage as well. There's a lot of name repeats on both sides of the lineage. But he had a daughter called Namar, who's said to be the wife of Noah, funnily enough. But if you go read this book, it's talking about the mark of Cain and what it actually is. And it's described as it being leprous, white, porcelain, vampiric skin, basically. So not like a Caucasian. We're talking like paper, bleached, white skin, you know, unnaturally white. You're not albinism either. You know, nothing like a genetic condition you could relate to today. I'm not getting all eugenic with people with this, you know. We're talking like a vampire white, unnaturally white skin. And Lamech goes on a journey to try and understand why he's cursed with this mark, and who did Cain sleep with to have a wife, you know, and how did he create more people? So even Lamech didn't know what happened in the beginning, you know, and he's a descendant of these people not far removed. So even he was in the dark. So I think it's interesting to imagine that, well, if the angels mated first with the daughters of Cain, and the mark of Cain perhaps was leprous white skin, well, there explains why the Nephilim would have had white skin immediately. It's inherited from their parents, they're on the mother's side.
Isn't this type this color indicative of lack of sunlight.
Yes.
Did you draw any directions from that cave-dwelling element there? Is there a connection?
You could say so, maybe not. I don't know. It seemed like Cain's lineage was quite active on the surface of the Earth. So I have no reason to believe that it was anything to do with the subterranean, sub-dwelling type of thing, which caused it by, let's say, some kind of micro-evolution or something, or adaptation to environment. I think it was quite literally a mark, personally. But I have heard, you know, this idea that there are subterranean civilizations even today, you know, which maybe the Nephilim Horde is now hiding underground or something like that, you know, waiting for the time to be released. It's something I've speculated a lot about on my channel with other people. But if we just go back to the origins of the Nephilim, I think it can be easily explained just through a genetic marker which was given to Cain, which therefore was passed down to the offspring of the Nephilim. Just white skin was the mark of Cain, and the Nephilim are infamous for having porcelain white skin, you know, especially on the face, particularly. But then I think if you imagine something like that, let's say, mixing with a dragon, well, serpents are pretty colourful creatures. They have a very colourful palette in nature. The same thing, let's say, for any reptile, not necessarily just snakes, but also for things like fish and insects, you know, nature's quite colourful. And I think when you get something like a serpentine dragon mixing with a very pale white-skinned human, you're going to get a very psychedelic blend of those two things together, and this is where the Nephilim really get their features from. And if you look at other mythologies, let's say, so let's go back to Greek mythology. I think Greek mythology is many of these mythos is just kind of told from a different perspective with different names. So you have this idea that there's the mother of monsters. She's called Echidna. Now, Echidna was a siren. Fundamentally, that's what she was. She was a siren. And it says in the Book of Enoch, the women who mated with the angels became sirens. So I thought that was quite interesting that was mentioned and worded. And it implies that the women who were once human changed genetically after having sex with a dragon of some kind. Now, it's never implicitly explained whether that was a punishment for doing what they did, or a gift from the angels for taking part and procreating with them. But if you go to Greek mythology, it seems like it was a gift, because Echidna was loved by the gods, and she had her own secret cave underground, so going off what you were saying there, made of gold, according to the myth, and she had this golden palace underground, and she would basically, her husband was called Typhon, and he was a serpent sea god. He had serpentine legs, and he was a part of the sea. He was like a Poseidon-type character, but he was assigned to the sea as a god. And he was mating with Echidna and creating many famous monsters of Greek mythology, such as the Chimera, the Gorgons, like Medusa and her two sisters, Cerberus, the three-headed dog, the Hydra, what's the other one? The one where you cut the head off and another one grows back. Think of an ancient Greek monster that's quite famous. There's like 12 of them. She birthed them, basically, by mating with this sea monster, which was particularly a serpent, a giant serpent dragon type creature. So that matches the Book of Enoch perfectly. The daughters of Cain, which became sirens, mating with dragon-like serpent gods. You know, it's all there. And her depictions are very pale skin, with two legs made of serpent. It's basically two serpent legs, two snake legs. And it seems like they were hybridized for the purpose of being able to birth monsters. Because I think a normal human woman trying to birth a giant would die. And I think many of them did. There's many stories in the Book of Giants, for example, of women just bursting open and dying at childbirth every time they were raped and had to give birth to another Nephilim giant, you know.
What movie does that sound like?
What, like Alien? Yeah, exactly. But this is the thing. So I think the angels hybridized these human women to be more hardy, more able and capable of birthing monsters, you know. And that was kind of like an upgrade gift, genetic gift to them, you know, some kind of genetic engineering, let's say. So these sirens, these snake women, you know, are quite infamous for birthing monsters. And Echidna in particular, she created the Gorgons. Now, the Gorgon quintessentially is a Nephilim, a perfect example of a Nephilim, which you can find everywhere else on the Earth. And it's, if you look at early depictions of Medusa, the most famous Gorgon, she's not this snake-haired monster with green skin, like you would imagine from like Jason and the Argonauts film, you know, something like that. Her most original depictions are just human legs, human arms, very white, very pale, white skin. She had wings, like an angel, but she had a human body. She had a very large head with a very wide grin with two sharp fangs, buck-tooth fangs coming from above and below. She had huge, wild, wild eyes bulging out of her head, and she had red dreadlocks. So she was a white-skinned, wide-grinning, bulging-eyed serpent-human-angel hybrid with red hair. That's the original Medusa. But she's kind of been stylized into this green-skinned snake woman with snakes for hair. It's kind of odd, really, but that's not her earlier depictions. In fact, you can find a relief, sorry, a pottery for vase. They're infamous for painting the gods on vases in the Greek, aren't they? And you can find this vase which has Athena on there. And Athena, on her chest, carries around the head of Medusa, which was gifted to her by Perseus after he slayed the Medusa. And she keeps it as like a good luck charm or a protection amulet. It's called a Gorgonian. And Gorgonians traditionally are on like the shields and breastplates of the soldiers as well of Athens. So Athena, the goddess of war, has the head of Medusa on there. And on this particular relief, it looks like a clown with fuzzy red hair and a big wide grin and a smile and red lipstick around the mouth and everything. It's because that's what you get when you hybridize a human with a serpent. You get a pale white-skinned, fiery red-haired, again, I think inherited from the angels, the fiery flying serpents. And I'm not talking ginger orange hair here. Again, there's a lot of people like to link my work to like red-headed people. Like humans, I think has nothing to do with that. I think what I'm talking about here is something else. Imagine blood red hair, not human colors. We're talking here. And they glowed. These are known as the glowing ones. They were half angel. They had powers far beyond what we can comprehend. They were awe inspiring, very large, very muscular, very terrifying to behold. Huge, wide serpentine mouths with sharp teeth, you know. And don't forget, a snake can dislocate its jaw to eat its prey. I think these human hybrids probably had something similar. And when you look at a snake from the front, it looks like it's smiling at you because it has such a wide mouth. I think these Nephilim look like they were smiling at you too. But imagine like a snake with human lips. Wouldn't that be weird? And I think the Nephilim had just that. They were like a serpent creature with human lips. Big, wide human lips. It would have been very odd to behold. And if, you know, you look at a clown, red lipstick all the way around this big wide mouth is pretty common. And that's probably what the Nephilim look like, you know, from the front view. And I guess, you know, you can create this stylized image quite easily just by looking at other cultures who have their representations of dragon-human hybrids. It's really common, in fact, that India have the Rakshasas, which are the offspring, well, the giant man-eating monsters. But all their depictions are basically identical to the Gorgon of Greece.
You're referencing the Greek monster, but the same monsters occur in other ancient cultures, is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. They just go by different names, and each culture has their own stylized, culturally specific aesthetic of doing it with their own names, you know, and each culture has their own mythos and story surrounding these characters, because in each geographical location where the Nephilim were, they would have had different encounters and different experiences and different stories to tell, you know. But fundamentally, they're talking about the same kind of creature. Giant, half-human, half-angel hybrids, which look like monstrous clown-looking creatures, you know, basically.
With bulging eyes.
With giant bulging eyes, just like a reptile, with huge wide grins with sharp teeth. Wild, pale white faces with multicolored polka dots scattered all throughout the skin, multicolored skin all over their arms and patterns all over the place, you know, just like a reptile. Huge glowing auras, wild, fiery red hair of some kind, and they were cannibals more often than not, you know. Not in every tale are they depicted as cannibals necessarily, but it seemed to be a very common theme, most found throughout. And you'll find every culture, like I said, talks about these things. And most of my work on my channel, like I said, I started the series in 2016, and I now have 44 episodes spanning over 8 years showing these cultures. So it's primarily an anthropological study, what I do. It's going through all these folk traditions found in all continents and every country, and they all have their own ancient folk tradition. And you'll find more often they are venerating their ancestor spirits during these rituals. And to venerate their ancestor spirits, they dress in a specific way. And now when they say ancestors, I make this point, they're not talking about what we traditionally think an ancestor is from our English standpoint. That's just the best word we've got for it. What they mean is like ancient primordial gods and builders of their civilizations, not humans, not like grandma or granddad or something, you know. We're talking about, they mean something else when they say an ancestor spirit, something more primordial, something far more ancient. So what they do, they dress in a specific way, they do a specific ritual involving a lot of rhythmic sound and dance and music. Often they couple that with extreme drugs and psychedelics, and they put on this costume for the sole purpose of channeling the spirit. They become open vessels to allow the spirit into them. And they dress specifically like a clown. Well, again, that's what my work is trying to show. They have the same style. They white the face up. They put patterns and polka dots all over the face and put a red nose on, or red up the nose in some way. And they put on a red headdress made of reeds or ribbons or feathers or whatever they've got available to them in their specific culture, in their specific geographical location, based on the specific wealth, you know, whatever they've got. And it's kind of, you see these similar aesthetical styles copied all throughout these cultures on every continent, because they're all trying to get in touch with the same thing. And they all wear very colourful patterned clothing, and by any description from a Western standard, it's what we would call a clown. Just again, with their own culturally specific twist on it. And they do it to be possessed. They'll tell you that's what they're doing. I'm doing it to allow the spirit into my body. I dress this way to mirror the spirit in the other realm, in the spirit realm. And if I create a mirror, then I create a channel which allows the spirit into my body. And then once the spirit's in my body, I let the tribe communicate with it through me. So it uses my mouth to talk to people, you know. And that's, they're not even like hiding it. The tribe knows that's what's going on. In some cases, like say in Korea, where you have the Mudang shamans who dress in quite hatmanish style, multicolored garbs, it's expected of them to communicate with spirits and let the spirit talk through them. In fact, it's considered a failed ritual if the spirit doesn't communicate through them, you know, and people pay good money to those shamans to communicate with the spirits. It's but that's more of a wealthy, modernized version of an ancient practice. But you find there's a lot of cultures that haven't changed much in some isolated places of the world who still practice these things as though it was 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years ago.
I think that's fascinating, Paul. Do anthropologists in the West downplay this and say they're warding off the spirits in these rituals?
You find it's called apotropaic. It's an apotropaic ritual is what they would describe that as, which is, again, the idea of it confuses the spirits and keeps them away while they perform the ritual so they don't interfere. Stuff like that, you know. Or it's, again, scares away the evil entities before the harvest or before the winter or something, you know. And I personally believe that's very naive. I'd say 95% of the world who practices these type of things, they do it to be possessed by the spirit, not to scare it away. So those cultures, and primarily Western cultures, so we have the Kukri, for example, in Bulgaria. They believe, you know, when winter comes and autumn ends, they roam through the villages dressed in giant psychedelic coloured, big wide mouth grinning monster clothing, with bells all over them, and they jingle their bells and dance around and walk through the village to scare away the bad spirits before the winter, you know. And then they have a giant party, and then they fast for 40 days for Lent, you know, Fat Tuesday, and they have, you know, it's kind of mixed in with Catholic ritual, you know. They've merged this ancient pagan practice with Catholic ritual. But I think it's naive to think dressing like an ancient thousand-year-old, multi-thousand-year-old entity is going to scare that entity away. I think that's a quite childish way of viewing the situation. As when you compare it to these other cultures who, let's say, the Theyam of the southeast region of India. You know, they have this ritual called the Theyam, and it's very old, predates Hinduism, do you know what I mean? And it continues today, if that's even possible. I mean, Hinduism's like the oldest religion on earth. They don't know when it began, but they do this ritual where they dress in a specific way, very clownish, very human serpent hybridish, you know, very colourful, and they channel the spirits. They can't both be right, is what I'm trying to say here. The Bulgarians and the Kukri and the Indians who practice the Theyam, they can't both be right. What's going on here? Are they dressing like demons to scare them away, or are they dressing like them to channel them? I'm going to go with the more older ancient practice and the more common practice. Dressing like a demon only strengthens the demon and creates a channel and a connection to the spirit, to the physical realm. It doesn't scare them away. You know, they can't both be right, is what I'm trying to say here.
Yeah, it made me think about the mechanism of putting on clothing that would approximate the appearance of the entity, and somehow this action channels an ethereal parasite. And I suppose you can inadvertently dress like the entity and not project the intention, but it's weird what that mechanism is, that they suddenly become a conduit to the underworld by mimicking.
The idea is, like, you know, Samhain, for example. It's quite topical. It's that time of year. You know, Halloween's around the corner. Samhain, this ancient Celtic belief that this is when the veil is thinnest and most and closest to the spirit in the physical realm. It's when they were almost touching each other, you know. And that's when, you know, dressing like things, or when rituals are more powerful, let's say. And that's when we, as people in the West, most dress like demons, you know. So you have to wonder what's going on there. And in a way, it's kind of dressing like something or mirroring something in the spirit realm creates like an as above, so below situation. And if you are practically one, so you end up looking like something that exists in this spirit realm, in the physical, then you've just become a willing vessel for that spirit to cross over and manifest, you know. And it's an ancient practice. This is ancient knowledge. You know, this has been done for centuries for the sole purpose of getting in touch with spirits. It's like a direct line telephone call. You know, it's one method, just one method. Powerful drugs are another way. Ritualistic dances is another way as well, you know. People do it through meditation in extreme forms and humming and sound frequencies. There's many ways to do it. The costume is just one. So you have to be careful about what you choose to wear. I mean, if you even look, and again, this gets into a lot of my own research, but you look at the modern world and you'll find the clown aesthetic is pushed on us even today, you know. And even in 2023, not that long ago, a year ago in January, the catwalks were sporting clown-like clothing and aesthetics. What does it mean to encourage an entire population of people to wear clown-like clothing when you consider this type of research and understanding in ancient spiritual practices? It's almost like they're purposely trying to get more and more people to be willing channels for demons. You know, if you want to go to the extreme conspiratorial end to this conclusion.
I do. And that made me think about this. And I want to get into that as we come to the top of the hour. I wondered about Mardi Gras in New Orleans. And what your thoughts were on that particular time of year. What are the connections there? Because you have clowns, you have jesters, you have all kinds of imagery there. White faces, clown makeup.
Okay, so Mardi Gras, as far as I'm aware, is like a European tradition of the wild man that got brought over to American colonization and kind of took on its own hybridized form. But its traditions do fundamentally come from Portugal, Spain, France, Italy, Venice, Carnival, you know, carnival. It's, again, often mixed in with Catholic pre-fasting rituals, a night or a week of hedonism and gluttony before not doing anything like that for 40 days, you know, and fasting and prayer and all that type of thing. And yes, the tradition is actually more ancient than that. And it goes back to, again, the Thracian culture in Bulgaria, where the Kukri still exists today, as I mentioned earlier. That's the most ancient example of this tradition of the wild man. And it goes back to even older Greek kind of Dionysus worship from Thracia, which is where Bulgaria is today, where Dionysus comes from as a foreign god to the Greek pantheon. But Dionysus is basically described in these ancient terms as a giant club-wielding party-goer reveler drunk who has a powerful horde of merry men, fauns and satyrs and wild beast men who follow him around everywhere from village to village, spreading the wild horde party, you know, and people get caught up in his spell and end up joining the party. And kind of you get these wild man traditions from these ancient stories, but also from the northern, more Teutonic regions of like Viking era, you know, type myths. You also have the wild man tradition kind of founded there as well. And it's very similar. It's these people dress like hairy, wide grinning, multicolored, fractaled, horned beast monsters and have a giant party and then fast. And you find that kind of has been pretty much consistent all throughout European tradition for a long time. And Mardi Gras is kind of like a more modernized version of that tradition that's got carried over into the West, even further into the West across the Atlantic. But you look at the costumes worn in the more early traditions. So let's go back to Portugal, the other side of Europe away from Bulgaria, right on the coast, you know, the western coast of Europe. Well, in Portugal, they have something called the Caretos. And the Caretos are quite literally multicolored, fractaled, patterned, snake-looking demon monsters. And they look very much like serpent human hybrids, you know, with these giant staffs covered in bells. Bells are very common. Sound and frequency is often mixed in with these representations. And they'll tell you, oh yeah, we represent demons. We're supposed to be demons. That's what we're dressing like. We don't really know why we do it. It's just tradition. You know, that's what they'll tell you. They don't know. It's just something they're proud of because it's a part of their heritage, but they don't know where it came from. And you find the wild man is in every single European country. The hairy beast, club-wielding beast, who went around cannibalizing and terrorizing humans all throughout Europe, pre-Middle Ages and in an ancient world, you know, and even some representations and tapestries show they were still knocking about eating people during the Middle Ages. You know, the wild man is quite an infamous beast, and it's basically the European flavor of Nephilim. And I think they were hairier in Europe because it's colder.
That's going to do it for the first hour of this two-part interview. Our guest is Paul Stobbs. His book is titled The Nephilim Looked Like Clowns, Volume 1, The History. In the second hour, we get into how the clown archetype is embedded in Western culture, such as in music, fashion, and film. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.